Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. The time is 1:32 p.m., and I would like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belts, Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. I'm excited to be with all of you again today. We will have our typical cast of labor and commerce characters here with us throughout the year. Director Chuck Collins, state auditor, many folks from the Division of Insurance, and all manners of folks that really make many things in our private economy run here in the state of Alaska. I would like to take a moment to recognize someone who has moved on from our typical slate of folks we might hear from here at Labor and Commerce this year. Steve Ramos from the Department of Administration has left the state, unfortunately, and we will miss his expertise on many issues here before the committee. So we certainly wish Director Ramos well in Idaho. Very well. Today is Friday, January 23rd. Members present today are Senator Merrick, Senator Ray Jackson, Senator Yunt, and myself, Chair Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to extend an especially warm Senate Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LIO moderators, Susan Quigley and Renzo Moses. We have one and one bill only on our agenda for today. It is House Bill 78, Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Option, brought to us by the House Finance Committee. Here to present the bill is the Honorable Representative Chuck Kopp and his staff, Julia O'Connor. Please join us at the table. This is our first hearing on the bill, so we'll go through a rundown of the bill, get kind of a general overview. I think three of us may be familiar with the bill, but as it is a new legislature and a new Labor and Commerce Committee hearing this bill this time around, we will have a thorough hearing on the bill and then move on from there. Representative Kopp, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair, Senator Bjorkman, and committee members. Greatly appreciate the opportunity to present for you today. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, House Representative for District 10, and I am accompanied today by my lead staff on this legislation, and I will allow her to introduce herself.
Yeah. Thank you. Julia O'Connor, staff to Representative Kopp.
Thank you. Committee members, we are excited to bring before you what we see as really an emergency fiscal response to what we see going on in our communities across the state and into our ability to deliver critically needed public services to the state of Alaska. We are currently in the middle of being recognized by our state agencies that to have a competitive, reliable service delivery, we need something transformative that is structural to the way that we look at our retirement system, beyond just pay and benefits, but a structural reform to look at delivering state services in a way that our agencies are not being hollowed out. Let's go to the next slide. Our current system has resulted in these headlines that we see every day across the state. Many of you are familiar with these. I don't need to really get into them, but we see that it is resulting in service delivery challenges from public safety to drivers for our school districts to our firefighters and public safety. And these are headlines that we are all very familiar with. They all tie back to, according to our state commissioners, their recruitment and retention challenges. Almost every single commissioner in the FY27 budget has identified that recruitment and retaining of personnel is their number one concern in their state agencies. We see that it isn't isolated, it's systemic in our system right now. Our agencies are not able to keep experienced staff, and they're highlighting this. So what has the state done? With public assistance just a couple years ago, we added $20 million to their budget and funded over 100 positions. And still, the turnover is so high, we know that we've been fined tens of millions of dollars for not handling public assistance programs correctly. That's also part of our headlines. The agencies that I'm talking about are reflected here. You see service delivery across the state. We're very proud of our public workforce, and this is a reminder that these people also issue the permits for heavy industry, mining, oil and gas, DEC and DNR. There are DOT engineers building bridges and roads, our highway system people, longshoremen. What a state we have. And this slide really reflects service delivery statewide. But I really want to draw your attention, Mr. Chairman and committee, to the quote from our state auditor at the bottom of this at a recent meeting just a couple months ago, November 11th of this last year, highlighting how the errors in the state audit of all agencies are going up exponentially. She said, historically, 30 to 35 significant financial process accounting errors are found. Now we're about 80 to 90. But what that really means and what our auditor highlighted is we have errors and omissions that are happening that are costing the state hundreds of millions of dollars. We have a single grant in FY24 where the state did not apply for reimbursement of a federal grant of almost $280 million because the Department of Health people who received a pass-through grant from Department of Military and Veterans Affairs for COVID-era relief did not know to apply for it, did not get it submitted on time. That's a lot of money to our state treasury. I think we can all agree with that. So that's an omission. An error would be the fines that we're incurring for not submitting timely reports, not getting public assistance, the temporary assistance to needy families, the money that we're getting from the federal government, not getting it out and reported back timely, so we're incurring fines. So those findings are nearly tripled, and what the auditor has said, it's directly related to our agencies not keeping experienced staff who are knowledgeable in the work and who can provide mentorship and training to new employees because the turnover is so high. They're always in a training mode. Those kind of compliance gaps create real risks and liability to state government. So this picture shows kind of what we're at right now. Next slide.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. I forgot to mention and recognize Senator Giesel, who has been here from the beginning of the committee meeting. She, of course, carried this bill in our committee there in the last legislature. Please continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So how did we get here? This is a slide that shows what happened to our defined benefit system that the state of Alaska had until 2006 when we opted for a new policy going into a defined contribution, essentially a 401k only. Prior to this time, our pension system was well funded. What happened is we entered about a three-year period where the state's actuary, Mercer, gave the state critically bad advice. The state in the lawsuit felt it was borderline criminal because when Mercer discovered their error, they failed to disclose to the state that we were under-contributing. Basically, the state got good news. You're fully funded. Your contributions are very low. Municipal governments, some of them were told they don't have to contribute at all. Everything was looking great. Mercer realized, no, that was bad advice, but they sat on it for a year and a half, at least because they knew they were going to lose a client, the state of Alaska. The state in the lawsuit estimates that we undercontributed between $1.8 and $2.8 billion. We know the time value of that money coming up today, compounded, is about $5 to $8 billion in liability. Just so happens to be that the liability we have of our legacy pension is right around $5.5, $6 billion. Now, have we done a good job since then? Yes. The legislature immediately pivoted, did a triple safeguard on the actuaries. We no longer rely on one, we rely on three. The Arm Board has their actuary, the state of Alaska has an actuary, and we have a third actuary that trues both of them up every few years. So we have taken steps in the right direction. But the argument that we left a bad system that was underfunded is not shown to be true in reality. We left a system as a reaction to terrible actuarial advice that did get us in trouble. So critics who would say that we ended up with legacy debt that was unfortunate are right, and we are rightly concerned to stay on top of that. What I want to do is not allow the fear of what happened here to paralyze us from making a structural reform to a modern retirement system that in no way resembles the higher risk systems of our previous legacy system. But today is a shared risk system that the actuaries say they are not even able to model a scenario outside of the normal market correction ranges that would ever introduce additional unfunded liability to the state. Next slide. We talked briefly about the Mercer information. This is a great slide. It's a little wordy, but I'm going to just break it down real quickly. The 2025 legacy defined benefit funding valuations are right here. TERS is currently funded at 80% and PERS at 70%. But I want to give this context. In 2014, Mr. Chairman, TERS was at 48% and PERS was at 54%. So we can see that the decisions that the state is making in the legacy system, which again is past service costs, it has nothing to do with future service of House Bill 78. I want to really keep this separate. But we are making great strides and we are on track to be 100% funded by 2039, which is considerable. It is going to be a celebration year for our state, and there is no reason to expect that we will do less than that. What I want to point your attention is to our returns. We are often criticized that the actuaries, which the legislature doesn't set, the Alaska Retirement Management Board actuary sets an expected return rate, and that's how they determine what the contribution should be. They set a return rate of 7.25. What did we get? Well, you heard the governor last night say that we actually got a 10% return. We just read the actuarial report. It's a very high 9. I think it's 9.6 or 9.7. The market return, that's like the spot price, was 11, but the averaged over the year was very close to 10%, and we've done that 2 years in a row. It has resulted in billions of dollars in excess returns that are driving the liability down. I heard a member of our body just the other day say we had $8 billion in liability. Actually, that's not true from the pension system today. That number is closer to 6 because the returns are doing good, and we have to give credit to our pension fund managers. I think they're doing a great job. So this shows that if you make your contributions and you have a good conservative management structure, even with a legacy high-risk tier, we're able to pay that off and get ourselves in a spot where a low-cost plan such as we're presenting here is going to bring a new future to our workforce and the security of our communities. Next, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to talk about the cost of doing nothing or the cost of what we're doing now in this situation. We've talked about the service disruptions and how expensive that is and what Alaskans are feeling every day with those service disruptions. What does that mean to the state treasury? It's the premium pay costs, the errors in admissions, which I talk about, and basically printing money and letting it go out the door by our training dollars and our churn, high turnover of employees, and never recapturing those costs. So instead of continuing to throw at it, we're trying to keep people in and keep them from going. This next slide really shows what that looks like. This is a premium pay slide. These numbers are all from our administration. This is overtime, holiday, hazard, double time, differential, standby, and on-call. Most of this is surrounding just covering staffing, as you can see, covering call-outs, and making sure you have minimum staffing levels met in agencies. In FY20, we had $83 million, essentially, in this premium pay. You can see in FY25, it went up exponentially to almost $150 million. And you can see only 6 months into this fiscal year, we are already at $112 million. Well, we can all do the math in our heads and look at, we are well on track to be over $200 million in this year. I would just like to point out that this cost alone is far more than double the cost of the investment of the new pension plan that the actuaries say absolutely will fill these seats. It is structurally designed to retain and hold on to personnel to deliver these services. It will drive these costs down. Will it make them all go away? No. Will it drive it down considerably? Yes. So workforce instability is a significant cost to the state, and that's not counting the errors in admissions that I talked about earlier, which are in the hundreds of millions by themselves, and it's not counting the projected savings to the state by reducing the employee churn and the training dollars that are going out the door. Next slide. This slide shows the workforce profile, and this is a picture of what is going on. When I talk about turnover, you can see most of our workforce is into 1 to 4 year range. And those slices of the pie are very big because people are coming and going in that range. And then the more senior ranges, that pie gets really narrow because we have fewer people staying on. We have half of our workforce in that 1 to 4 year range. Next slide. This slide shows what's going on financially with the employee retirement plan that we currently have in a defined contribution. It shows the behavior that is being incentivized in our current plan. So this is from the ARM board. The last 12 months ending June 30 showed that the PERS and TERS plan withdrawals in the DC plan were $160 million. But if you add their supplemental annuity and the deferred compensation cash outs, it's nearly $500 million. Again, that was in just 1 year, 12 months. 90% of those are happening after 5 years of service when you can collect your employee and your employer contributions together and you can go. And most of those people are leaving public service entirely and they're not coming back. So we've incentivized a cash and go plan. If we treat people like day labor, that's what they'll do. They'll take the money and they'll go, but we are not incentivizing behavior of people to buy homes, start businesses, build families, and build community, and put their kids in school, and become, you know, anchors of our state. This next slide shows what is going on with a decline in their full-time state agency positions. Again, these are numbers from the administration. It shows that the positions filled is declining year over year. I would point out that the little bump up a percent or two more recently were our bonuses and our wage increases that we make. And then you can see it dropped off again because wage bonuses aren't sustainable. And so it dropped off again sharply once we stopped giving sign-on bonuses and in cash bonuses. So overall, the state for a number of years now has been in decline. I really want to draw your attention to the DOT number at the bottom, 24.5% vacancy. Which agency now are we most desperate to be staffed appropriately to get work out on the road so our contractors can be fixing our roads and bridges? And it's this agency that has said they cannot be competitive with the private sector when they are hiring away their engineers and project management leads faster than they can get them trained. And that is why we have our contracting community so concerned about DOT's capacity to get work out on the road. This picture explains a little bit of what's happening there. Next slide. So this is the real question before us is, do we want our state to be competitive again like we were in the 80s? Many of us growing up here, I'm a lifer, you know, lifelong Alaskan, and grew up around the state in rural and urban communities. And I remember when our positions, whether you work for DOT or whether you were a teacher or public safety or whatever your job was, they were competitive jobs, and people would move to Alaska because of that job. And we see that that's not the case now. So we have to compete nationally for talent. We are in a race for that. We are the only state that does not have a competitive retirement system, no pension for teachers or public safety, and we don't offer Social Security. So we bring people up here, they work 20, 25 years, and they realize they've never contributed to Social Security. And then all of a sudden they think, man, I better get another part-time job in addition to my teaching job where I can contribute to Social Security. Otherwise, when I hit 62, 65, 67, there's nothing there for me in Social Security. So that's a disincentive. When we look at that, we realize what we're talking about today is an emergency fiscal response. House Bill 78 is not a luxury. It is a plan that is going to be a net revenue positive to the state and help stabilize our workforce and stop the bleeding of talent and the crumbling of our resource delivery services. So now we're looking at our proposed solution. and that is a brand new competitive plan, Mr. Chairman. It's actuarially modeled and proven to be responsible. The shared risk in it includes retirees. It includes current employees and the employer, all with skin in the game, no longer like the old system where the employer bared all the risk. And we'll see that the states that are doing this are doing very well. We look at it as a very strategic investment in our workforce, and it's modeled on best practices to keep us solvent. Next slide. So here is how it is structured. The employee contribution is 8 to 12% model. So they'll start off at 8% of their pay will go into the plan. That is consistent with what we're doing now. It can be adjusted all the way up to 12% based on this 90% trigger. The actuary, it's an audited annual report, says the fund has hit 90% or lower. The ARM board can raise it all the way up to 12. Now, the actuaries say that every 0.1% raises a lot of money, so they never see big jumps happening, but they said because the plan does react live to the market, it's extremely hard for it to ever go into an underfunding position, and this is only one of the triggers that does this. So employees share the risk, and they contribute more if the market has a downturn. Next slide. So then we look at states. I said other states do this. There's a number of states that have an 8 to 10% range. We are suggesting even a higher range, so more of a skin in the game for employees going all the way up to 12%. The states that have this have an average funding valuation well over 80. In fact, I think the average there is 85%. Some states are over 100%, and that one actually would be Wisconsin. They're 105. So these are practices that we know are working well in states. Next slide. This one shows the employer contribution. Right now, PERS employers are capped at 22% payroll. But just to give us an example of what that is, 22% of payroll statewide is $440 million. That's what local government pays in. TERS is 12.56%. Every percent is about $20 million in payroll. The reason why TERS got a better deal, a lower cap, is they actually needed more help at the time from the state when school districts were in 2008 when they modeled this. They said local government has more capacity to bring more money. School districts have less capacity. So the state just made an agreement, said we'll cover school districts more above a lower cap. So this bill does not propose changing the amount that local governments pay. They're still capped, and school districts are still capped at these amounts of 22 and 12. But notice the lower end, Mr. Chairman, and this is what's important. The lower end is 12, and that's just the floor. And the reason why we put that there is because the actuaries say the actual cost of this pension going forward, when the legacy debt is paid off in 2039, it's 10.05% for PERS. It's 9.5% for teachers. What is that going to mean to local governments? Hundreds of millions of dollars in immediate fiscal relief. It's going to mean hundreds of millions of dollars in additional cost to the state where they don't have to. There is no paying above the cost of the cap. There will be no cap that's been exceeded. So conservatively, when the legacy pension debt is paid off, we are looking at $300 to $400 million a year in savings between local government and to the state, by just staying the course, paying the legacy debt off, making the responsible payments the state is making, and we have a new day coming. Some would say, well, why don't we just wait to 2039 to make this new plan? I think the response, Mr. Chairman, is do we want to continue this churn for the next 13 years and continue the spiral we're on, or arrest it now and have an incrementally small cost compared to what we're doing now, the cost of doing nothing, and in a decade be in an entirely different situation. So next slide. So here we see a little more of the structure, Mr. Chairman. It's a five-year vesting period for PERS and TERS. That's consistent with the prior pension plan under Tier 3 PERS, and it aligns PERS and TERS. You probably remember, Mr. Chairman, as a teacher, the TERS used to be 8 years for vesting, and so under here we just made it the same as PERS. It's easy administratively, and And we feel like there was some fairness in that with similar service times that employees are vested with 5 years of service. Next slide. So the qualifications for retirement. What does it take to get your pension? This answers that question. If you're in a non-public safety position, you need to be 60 years of age with 5 years of service, or at any age as long as you've done 30 years of service. So if you start right out at, let's say you're 22 years old, you get a job as a teacher, you could retire at 52, or a police officer, the same thing, 30 years of service working straight through, you would have earned your pension. I'm not talking about anything other than the pension right now. PERS public safety, it's a little shorter. Age 50 with 25 years of service or 55 with 20 years of service. Why is it shorter? It has to do with the health care aspects of the job and the fact that, they just wear out faster, and you don't want old firefighters and policemen wrestling 20-year-olds. That's kind of the bottom line. Public safety lifestyle a little tougher on you. As a retired police officer, I'll vouch for that. next slide. Retirees have skin in the game. This is really a big one, because what this plan does not do is it doesn't bring back the cost of living allowance of the old pensions, where when you turn 65 years old, you get a 10% increase in the base of your pension. That all went away because it was expensive and necessary to keep it solvent, but it literally saves the plan hundreds of millions of dollars. Next slide. What we have done is we've made the inflation protection, the inflation proofing, based on market valuation. If the fund drops below 90%, you can lose your you can lose your inflation proofing or have it reduced. And this is important because it does keep the plan solvent. And you can see the states that do this are funded very well. You'd say, well, excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to drink water.
Brief at ease.
Thank you. Under siege.
We're back on the record. It's 1:59 p.m. Please continue.
Thank you for that kindness, Mr. Chairman. On the inflation proofing, again, this is how retirees have skin in the game, is they will lose that 1.5%, 2% maybe bump that the ARM board recognizes as the impact of inflation on their dollar. That can just go away, so they basically are flat funded. The dollar amount doesn't change, but that's how they share the risk. And the actuaries have said that makes this plan very strong. And there is not a lot of states that do this, but the ones that we found that do it, you can see they have very strong retirement, well-funded plans. And that keeps everybody with skin in the game, which that's what we want, is a shared risk plan. Next slide.
Representative Kopp, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of wondering, as many people like to sharpshoot legislation and poke holes, which is our job.
Mm-hmm.
But are there states out there that have plans similar to this proposed plan, that their plan is in trouble? It's underfunded, it's going down. Are there examples of that? Could we go out there and find some state that has a plan similarly constructed and it's not doing well?
I've been at this since 2016, and I haven't found any plan that has this type of shared risk that's anywhere close to being in trouble. You know, I mean, I think, you know, plans that are like this, they are solidly in the mid-80s to over 100% funded. They're very solid. Our plan is unique in that it has actually more funding trigger levels than any other plan I've seen that share the risk. There's very few plans that do the inflation proofing that have a 90% trigger that can move the employee and employer contribution to adjust to the market to keep it at 90% funded. It's rare to have all those things coming into play. That's what this plan does. We wanted to go overboard to have a plan that would consistently be well-funded. And if the legislature finds 10 years later that they don't want a pension that's 130% funded, the way you can adjust that down is you can say, well, maybe a teacher doesn't have to work for 30 years. Maybe they can work at 28 years and get their pension. But future legislatures can decide that. What we wanted to do is make sure that what we had on the table was something that was as bulletproof as possible. And our review of states that have all these levers, and it's not just our review, it's the state's actuary. David Kirshner, the person that the state of Alaska relies on more than the other actuary to keep us out of trouble, has said this plan and their 25-year modeling, they do not see it producing any future unfunded liability. In fact, they don't think the 90% levers will ever be triggered because it's structured so conservatively with the shared risk between the retirees, the employees, and the employers. So I'm confident that we're not going to find a situation or a state that's like ours because it is unique how we've structured it, or one that has these levers that is underfunded.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So retirement medical coverage. This is an important slide. A lot of questions around medical care. We found people care about this more than we all do. Health care is really a big deal. What we have done, I think, to improve what current employees are facing is there is a requirement for all current employees that work in this legislature, that work for the state or local government, who are in the defined contribution plan, they have to retire directly from the plan. Now, what that means is that to get your State of Alaska supplemental health card, when you hit Medicaid age at 65, if you didn't have your minimum years of service, and let's say you're a teacher and you were required to work 30 years, but you worked 20, you would have to come back at 64 years of age and work that year so you could retire directly from the plan into Medicare at 65. So you would hope a senator or a House member would hire you as a staff member at 64. So I'm just giving you an example. I mean, you do. You have to come back and get that job and work for a year because it requires that you be actively employed in the plan 12 months prior to retirement. The only way you could avoid that is if you work straight, did your 30 years as a teacher or your 25 years as a police officer, and you had all your time. But that's not the way a lot of people do. They'll work 10 years, they'll be gone, they'll go in the private sector for a while, and then they'll come back and work a few more years. So we remove that requirement to retire directly from the plan because it acted as a gatekeeper to keep people from ever getting their medical eligibility. And in talking to the Alaska Retirement Management Board and about our overfunded health trusts, we know they're 150% overfunded, 138% funded, depending on whether it's PERS or TERS. We are in a significant overfunding situation. So we're looking at how can we be more fair to employees, because what the bill requires is that you serve a minimum of 10 years. If you serve 10 years, you will get your supplemental state health to help offset the cost when you are basically dumped onto Medicare. You'll have some assistance from the state. Now, do you pay more premium if you only work 10 years? Yes. Employees who work 25 to 30 years will only have about a 20% premium. Employees who only work 10 years can have about a 40 to 50% premium. So the premium takes care of that. Your years of service are awarded by giving you a low-cost supplemental health plan when you turn 65 to supplement Medicare. So you see here what we've done for PERS and TERS. To get your pension, yes, you have to work 30 years, but to get your health care, your full health care, we lowered that to 25 in this bill. We did that working with the ARM board, modeling this out, and they say this won't even make a dent in the overfunding of the health trust. For public safety, you still have to work your 25 years to get your pension, but you can get your full health care eligibility when you got 20 years in. We the idea was there is that's the main concern of people and families is to have health care. And why make them have to – you don't want somebody hanging on just for the health care. That's the worst thing in the world, to be trapped in a job. We thought if we have severely overfunded health trusts and we can do that, it's good for our workforce. It's good for our communities. And then you can see how we fund this, you know, as far as building up their health savings account, health retirement account. You get 3% of the average payroll in your job class goes into a contribution of your individual health retirement account if you're a PERS or TERS, and if you're a public safety, it's 4% of your job class. It's not 4% of your pay. It's 4% of your entire job class for equity reasons, because whether you're the commissioner of public safety or a first-year police officer or same thing with educators, your health care needs are the same. So that's the average of the job class.
Thank you. Senator Yontes, question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Through the chair to the representative. So help me understand, and I think I got a grasp on it, but for those at home too. So one of our police officers works 22 years, 23 years, and so they qualify for the health insurance part, but they don't for the pension. What does that look like? How much of their actual retirement do they get? Do they leave just with their own contributions at that time? What does that look like when you don't make it to the finish line and you don't actually fully qualify for the pension? Can you please explain that?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Yump, thank you for that. Very good question. So every year of service, you accrue a percent of your base pay. So they don't lose that. So to your point, if they worked 22 years and didn't quite make it to 25, they would have accrued 22 years worth of service, which I can just tell you off the top of my head, that's going to be around 40-some percent of their base salary would safely be theirs. Now, at 22 years, they would be eligible to get their pension based on a minimum of 20 years of service, and they're at least 55 years of age. Their other option is to work 25 years of service, and then they can retire at 50. But they won't lose that. Once in public safety, you are pension eligible at 60 years of age, no matter what. Now, you may have to wait to draw that pension until you're 60, but you don't lose any of that time. But if you're in your example you gave me at 22 years, they would have already had the minimum beyond 20 to be able to draw their pension. Yeah.
Senator Yount.
Okay, so and we're only talking about this because they've reached the 20 to get the health insurance. So young state trooper starts at 22 years old, and at 44 years old, he just – that's it. He can no longer serve for whatever reason, physical – where they move out of Alaska, whatever it may be. And so he or she, they get the full health insurance, but then they can't collect the full pension until they're older.
55, right.
55 at that time. And then it's only going to be whatever percentage.
Right.
And if they'd stayed the 25 years, what would the percentage of their
If they started at 22, they would have been able to, if they worked the 20 years or the 25 years straight, they would be – well, 22 plus 25, 47 years, not very old, they would be able to get a pension.
Okay.
But under those scenarios, yes, there is, to your point, there's a waiting period. You work 22 years, if you're only 44 years old and you're not yet 50 or 55, there's going to be a period of time where you have to wait to collect your pension. That does make the bill more affordable. Would love to be able to say, hey, you know, you can collect your pension based on what you've accrued right away. But one of the things that makes this so fiscally conservative is there is a minimum waiting period. If you haven't completely satisfied your required minimum years of service to get your pension. But again, with 22 years of service in public safety, they would have met the minimum. And then now it's just the age limit that they're waiting for so they can collect it. So it's 20. If you worked for 20 years, you're able to collect it at 55. If you worked 25 years, you can collect it at 50.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
I think this might be a good opportunity to bring up this point. In 2021, the Supreme Court came out with a decision in the Metcalf case that changed the landscape a tiny bit about this issue. And at that time, people raised the specter that suddenly throngs of former state employees would come out of the woodwork to reclaim a benefit in a Tier 1 or Tier 2 legacy pension. It's been some years since that decision has been into effect. Have we seen that happen at all? Is there concern that that is happening? Does this bill have any effect on what has occurred since the Metcalf decision?
Yeah, great question. Thank you, Chair Borkman. So this bill does not affect or impact or in any way have a nexus with that court legislation. That court legislation, you're correct, was referring to the legacy pension and people who had served in it. Maybe it was just a year or two or a short period of time left. Would they ever be eligible to get back into it? That has been ruled upon. I don't know how many people actually took. I know there were some that did certainly take advantage of that. This pension is completely divorced and separate. It's a separate trust account for the pension, a separate health trust account. It is a brand new plan, in no way tied to the legacy. And one of my efforts in presenting this is to show how it is a completely modern, separate plan that's no way tied to the legacy debt. Do I want the legacy debt to be paid off? Yes. Will this put us back in that situation? Absolutely no way. That's not Representative Kopp talking. That's our state's actuary who told the House Finance Committee what's the best plan the state could have. Representative Tomaszewski or Representative Josephson asked the question. He said, without a question, it's this plan. It's a defined benefit plan as proposed in this. He said, it's better for the employer and it's better for the employee. And he's the person that keeps us out of the ditch. So, again, it's not tied to that. That court case was allowing people to get back into that. But it won't affect our proposed payoff date of 2039. We haven't seen anything with modeling that shows it like produced a bump in liability that we're concerned about.
Very well. Thank you. Yeah. Just wanted to ask a question. It's been 5 years. Wanted to know if we've
right.
seen throngs of people return, as was forecast by
right.
by some. And we have not.
Right. That's correct, sir.
Thank That's you. Fine. Please continue.
So how is the choice design? You know, we get a lot of questions around choice in this plan and what does it look like for current employees and new employees. So how the plan is before the committee now is that all defined contribution plan members, all current employees in the defined contribution plan will have 180 days after this becomes law to make a selection. If you're defined contribution, you can stay a defined contribution employee. You have 6 months to decide to stay, or you have 6 months, 180 days to decide, no, I want to enter the defined benefit plan. So 180 days, during that time, the ARM board is going to put out an actuary analysis of individual accounts so employees know exactly how many years of defined benefit service their defined contribution account can purchase. Will it be a year for a year, or will it be a multiplier so it's a little bit less, and then they'll be given options to equivocate it so that it's equal or accept that maybe they have a year less in DB. Defined benefit plan benefits are more valuable because, one, they provide a lifetime pension. Two, the death and disability benefits are better. So those benefits, of course, are worth more. And the other thing that this has is inflation proofing. So that's one reason why a defined benefit plan costs more, simply the benefits are more valuable. But the goal is to have a one-for-one buy-in be as close to that as possible. And the market returns we're currently having, a lot of employees will be able to buy in one-for-one because the markets are doing well. So it depends on market experience. New employees, what if you're a brand new employee applying? The new employees will be default enrolled in the defined benefit plan, but they will have a choice to opt out into the defined contribution plan. Maybe they're coming up for just 1 or 2 years or 3 years and they know it. They can immediately opt into the defined contribution plan. But that choice remains open to them until the five-year vesting. So there's 5 years when they can decide which plan ultimately do they want to be in. That is how that is structured at this point. Next slide.
Senator Young.
Thank you, through the chair and to Representative Cobb. So I wanted to touch on that a little bit, that option. Mm-hmm. For me, I mean, so I've been studying the past retirement system and trying to learn as much as possible about it because I know this is going to be a big topic in the future. And I have no doubt in my mind that the failure of that plan had a lot less to do with the concept than it did with the organization of which the state of Alaska had hired that told us not to put money in. Right? That was a terrible idea. Time value of money is a real thing. And so, but one of my concerns was, and maybe this is being laid to rest right now, I just want to clarify, but somebody would have the option for either a DB or a DC, right? That's correct. And for up to 5 years.
Right.
Right. If they get past 5 years, I guess it's pretty clear in 10 or 15 years they wouldn't have an option to get back into it, right? But has there been any discussions on removing that option and trying to take away the option for people to do that and just go only with the defined benefit program or –
Yes. So through the chair, Senator Yount, the discussion to this point, it's been a vigorous one really on in the other body as well, is it better to have a permanent choice in the system for new employees coming in? The proponents say if you are looking for engineers or specifically more technical positions for projects, a lot of those people would probably want to come up and be in a DC plan. They know they're going to be here 2 or 3 years, and that would make it be more attractive to hiring those people. The other school of thought is that the larger your defined benefit pension pool is, the stronger it is. And if that truly is the plan that we believe will help stabilize, and I certainly do believe it'll have a strong stabilizing effect, that we want to, you know, have people in that as a default enrollment. Right now, the choice is there, as you point out, Senator, for up to 5 years. That choice remains. I mean, it's a policy choice. The committee could extend that, but it is nice to have kind of a drop dead date, just for the sake of the plan, that employees are locked in at by a 5 year mark to one or the other.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a fair time frame. I will say, going back, and I was going to touch on this, but you already did, and I'll build on it, is this state is built on very few people have been here a long time. Like my mom's side of the family goes back to the late 1800s. My dad's pretty new. He was in the mid-70s, right? Right. People come here in because of opportunity, right? And maybe it's short-term. I think a lot of people's story is they came here for a year or two or a project or to try something out. Mm-hmm. And they fall in love with the place, and they never want to leave. And I would, you know, if we took that choice away and didn't allow them to have that five-year choice, then they might be reluctant to come here in the beginning, right? Like you're saying, if we're trying to attract talent or engineers or whoever it may be, I would just be very reluctant to try to take that away because that might be what actually helps them get here, and then they decide to stay, right? And so Yeah, I'm glad to hear there is a choice. I was not aware of that, and so I just wanted to clarify and follow up on it and say I do. I think that's a good idea.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, I think we covered that, yeah. So this, what does it cost? People say, well, you know, what is your plan cost? So here's the slide. The additional state contributions, this slide, if you just let your eyes go all the way over to the furthest right-hand column, that $467 million is the key number, as you can see, for 13 fiscal years, the total investment from the state to cover the costs above and beyond the 22% cap for local government is $467. So about $36 million a year would be the investment that we're making for local government to have this pension option for their employees. The next slide shows what it would be for just state employees. So for state employees, where the state is paying the full cost, not just above 22% of payroll, is $687 million spread out over 13 years. So that's about $52.8 million. So you can see that total cost is a little bit north of $80 million a year. Now, I would remind the committee that this investment has to be looked at in light of the costs of what we're doing now, we know that we are on track to pay over $200 million in just this fiscal year in overtime, that we are paying hundreds of millions of dollars in fines and errors and omissions, not submitting for grants that we have funds coming back to us that are reimbursable, and we're not able to capitalize on savings, which are conservatively estimated at $76 million a year. That puts that number in really a stark contrast, and I look at that as an investment in stabilizing the service delivery to Alaska. But those are the costs, not what we're saying. That's what the actuary is saying. And I would also remind the committee that in 2039, when our unfunded liability from the legacy debt is paid off, Alaska is going to be in a fantastic spot going forward. Next slide. So what do Alaskans say about this? A couple of years ago, Patinkin Surveys did a statewide survey. They surveyed every district in the state. They surveyed labor households, non-labor, private sector, public sector. We saw almost a 70% favorable response towards this type of a structured shared risk retirement plan. You can see every area of Alaska. Interior, Kenai, Southeast, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Mat-Su, what the favorability was, what the option, what the opposed was, and what the undecided and unknown was. So we saw that we had some education to do. The average unknown in Alaska or undecided was 15%. So, but at first blush, most people know we have to do something to improve the retirement system that we have. It doesn't take a lot of convincing because most people are living in communities where they are concerned about turnover and churn, and they're hearing about it at their local council and assembly meetings, and they know it's a real factor. Next slide. So internally, so that's externally. Internally, our Department of Public Safety surveyed their own employees, 458 employees. 82.6% made it clear they preferred a defined benefit. Now, what this shows is for those employees that have a defined benefit, almost 97% of them, that's what they wanted to be in. And 3.3% said, no, I'd rather be in a defined contribution. So if you have a DB, you know what you have, you want it. If they were in the defined contribution plan, 75.7% said, I'd rather be in a defined benefit plan. And 23% said, I'd rather be in a defined contribution. And that's how you get your average of 82.6% prefer a DB. So we have a pretty reliable survey sample knowing where our employees are at. But what's important, when you look back to the previous slide on the actuaries that we were talking about, is the actuaries give us the most conservative number, assuming 100% of your employees are going to choose DB. But they also say they're not. You're going to have 80-20, maybe 75-25 split, and these numbers will be less. Your costs actually will be less. They will not be this high, but we have to give you a fully loaded cost, assuming 100% of your people are all going to come out of the defined contribution system and go into the defined benefit. So I wanted to remind the committee that the numbers I'm giving you are the most expensive it could possibly be, and our actuaries are saying it will not be this much, but our fiduciary duty is to tell you that if you had 100% people choose it, that's what it would be. So just wanted to give some context to that. So now we're just to the emphasis that we are really investing in our state's economy. And it's not anything other than what can we do to lower our training costs, lower our turnover, provide better services to Alaskans, which is really what this comes down to. We know that. We're seeing more and more extreme weather events, whether it's fire suppression, flooding, winter storms, plowing. We know we need our educators, our plow truck drivers, our public safety people. I mean, we get this intuitively as Alaskans. This is a world-renowned economist, Dr. Teresa Ghilarducci, who's been a pension officer for red states, blue states, worked for President Bush on his at a cabinet-level position on retirement programs. And she looked at what we're doing here in Alaska and said, the most conservative estimate I can give you is the state will see a minimum of $76 million a year, bottom-line savings to the Treasury, just from saving these lost monies right here, the training costs, the lost workforce hours, and and basically restoring the services to Alaskans that they're already paying for. I've already mentioned the errors in admissions that we're doing and our high rates of premium pay. Next slide. So the plan we are recommending and offered the committee for their consideration is one that our actuaries are saying will reduce the high turnover. It will improve your retention of personnel. It'll keep knowledgeable people on the job. You'll be able to keep your more technical people, like your finance officers that are vacating our agencies, which is causing the audits to be so poor. Those more skilled technical positions, this is what that's addressing. We do look at it as a very strategic investment in our workforce culture. And I would just quote from David Kirshner at the House Finance hearing. He said, if you want to help future retention, this plan is going to reduce your turnover. It's going to incentivize people to stay. You will find that you will meet your goals as stated and argued for that the state needs right now. And that's the actuary's expectation. So in closing, Mr. Chairman, I just want to clearly separate the two concepts that are often conflated in this pension discussion. And the first is Alaska's legacy pension liability. That liability comes from retirement tiers that closed 20 years ago. It is already on a fixed amortization schedule under current law and is expected to be fully paid off by 2039. That obligation exists whether we pass House Bill 78 or not. House Bill 78 does not add to that legacy debt. What House Bill 78 addresses is the cost of future service, the cost of providing a stable retirement benefit that's going forward. And according to Gallagher's actuarial analysis, again, the state's actuary, the normal cost of House Bill 78 by itself, unburdened by anything other than what is the plan cost, is 10% of payroll for PERS. What are we paying now? Local governments are paying 22%, and the state is paying another 5, 6, 7% more. It's going to go all the way down to 10% under this plan. And for TERS, the teachers, 9.55%. Those numbers matter because they are so far below this what the statute cap is already requiring them to pay. That means once our legacy liability is paid off, Alaska is going to transition from a high-cost, unstable system to a predictable retirement structure with contribution rates that are materially lower than today's levels. Doing nothing does not make these costs go away, but it guarantees we continue paying legacy debt while absorbing the much larger and less visible cost of workforce instability, premium pay, turnover, vacancies, and service failures. House Bill 78 is not about expanding pensions. It's about finishing the job responsibly, paying off what we owe, and putting in place a retirement system that is affordable, predictable, and capable of retaining the workforce that Alaska depends on. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for your patience, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Rep. Kopp. Any questions? Senator Yount.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Kopp. So couple more. We're going to go back to the time value of money here. And it, you laid to rest a really big concern of mine earlier. Life expectancies are increasing. That's a good thing. They're a lot longer than they were when our grandparents were here, our parents, right? So the shared risk part, I appreciate that. I'm glad that's in there. Was that in the last plan from 20-plus years ago?
No, it wasn't. All the risk was on the employers.
Okay. So, yeah, that's a massive improvement, and especially as artificial intelligence comes into the market, it does probably start helping us detect diseases earlier and live longer, right?
Yes.
The trigger, when you drop down to 90%, then the employee can go from an 8% to a 12% contribution. Is there a trigger prior to 90, or is that when it hits? Does it softly start setting in at 98, 96, 94, or does it – wait till 90?
Through the chair, Senator, yeah, that's a great insightful question. So it is at 90%. And the reason why that came up is the actuaries look at 90% as kind of being the gold standard for pension funding. In other words, your projected liabilities compared to the assets that you have in the plan If you're funded at 90% or more, that's what they look at as the ideal standard for a pension long term. And so we arrived at that with the consulting looking at that, but there is no mechanism. 90% would require them to kick in. The bill doesn't say that they may not be for then, but 90%, that is what activates the trigger.
Yes. I would just encourage you to look at it. If it gets all the way down to 90%, you wake up as an employee one day and you go from 8% to 12%, that 4% is 50% over the original 8%. It's a big change in your paycheck, right? And then really, you've lost the opportunity for time value of money. Now you're trying to make up for your investments on the backside, where maybe they would have rather preferred putting in 8.25, 8.5, 9 for a while and never getting down there. So it's just something to look at. I think I got all my questions for today answered.
Through the chair, Senator Yent, so I don't think I emphasized this well in my initial rollout, and I apologize, but the actuary, our David Kirshner, the state's actuary, said that every 0.1% of increase actually raises tens of millions of dollars. So he said if there was an adjustment made, it would be like going to 8.1. And when they modeled all the market corrections that, you know, you and I have seen in the last 15 years, they were never able to come up with a market situation where the plan ever got down to 90%, even with those corrections in it. But they said, should we need to do that, it would be a small bump. But to address your concern, which I think is great, I mean, you're right, it would be a shock to an employee to go from 8 to 12. But it just sets a range. So it would have to be, you know, if there was an increase like that, it would be something catastrophic that we have not seen in our lifetimes. So,
and then real quick, if you could please just speak into the record, who it is that's looking all this over that doesn't have a vested interest on either side? Who are the third-party companies that are involved? Who's taking a look at it that's not working on behalf of either side?
Sure. Thank you. Great question, Senator Young. So the fiduciary duty and the people who look out for the state's interest are the actuaries. So that would be David Kirshner of Gallagher & Associates. That would be the Armboards actuary, and that would be a third-party actuary who the state hires to double-check both of those. I don't have the names of those people. I think one of them is – I don't know if it's Callan. But the Armboard has their – so you talk about third parties. The state relies on these – basically CPAs, but they specialize in pension finance.
Thank you. And perhaps between now and the next committee hearing, if you could come back with who it is, their experience, other states they're working with, and their resume, perhaps, just so that we can – there's people out there that want to make sure that
absolutely
we're working with good individuals. So.
Thank you, Senator. We'll do that.
Any further questions? Appreciate the commentary from Senator Yent and your answers, Representative Kopp. In talking about, just by way of my own comments on your presentation, thank you very much for that. In talking about the main functions and need for this piece of legislation, number one, I think you very well addressed the need to save money and additional cash that the state is literally bleeding because we can't attract and retain employees. So thank you for bringing that to light. Part of that also includes people who come here for a time and they don't have or they're not encouraged by our retirement plan and system to stay. And I think when we talk about the option of choice for new employees, I think we really need to discuss that and having a system that allows people to practice some kind of tourism here. But also what the alternative is when people come to our state and then choose to leave with their defined contribution plan, that money leaves our plan, which you point out on slide 9, if folks want to refer to the amounts of money on slide 9. What that's meant for our plan currently is that our plans could have had in them those amounts of money, $160 million, $500 million for years and years. But since we started having defined contribution plans, which essentially flow money, hundreds of millions of dollars out of the state and out of our retirement systems, that's a significant hit to what could have been dollars that were used or would have been used to pay off our past service cost of the old plan. So as we look at this, we see allowing an option in this bill, although it does have some tertiary benefits, it weakens the financial strength of this plan and makes it less financially conservative. Also, I think it's important to remember that when people pay into a pension and they choose to leave after a few years, the amount of money that they rightfully earn in their pension, it doesn't go away. They still are able to get a payment from the pension that they have earned when they're eligible for it, when they reach the pensioner age. The benefit to the state of Alaska and all of the rest of the employees that remain in that plan is that the money that they have invested in their pension, it stays with the state of Alaska so that we all and that pensioner themselves with that little bit of money there, they experience benefit from that money growing over time. The way it's set up currently, and if a choice option is allowed to remain in the bill, that money leaves. And it does not, it may benefit that person who comes to Alaska to visit and says, oh, hey, nice place, back to Montana for me. They get to take that money, but Alaska, they kind of get left holding the bag of retraining and all of the costs that we just discussed. So that's kind of the flip side for me of this choice issue. It is all about the time value of money and having Alaska dollars that we put out in payroll stay in Alaska for the benefit of all Alaskans instead of shipping them out somewhere else to join someone else's plan. That's how I feel about the issue. So appreciate that. Did you have any invited testifiers that you'd like to join us today?
Sherman, we do not.
Very well. Well, you did great.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Okay. Seeing no further questions, comments, or clarifications on this bill, we will set House Bill 78 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. Our next meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will occur on Monday, January 26th, when we will again take up House Bill 78, as well as Senate Bill 170, Gaming Electronic Poll Tabs. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee at this time, we are adjourned at 2:39 p.m.
Thank you.